Welcome to the Africa Urban Lab podcast. I'm your host, Curtis Lockhart. On today's episode, I talk with Stefan Durcan. Stefan is a professor of economic policy at the University of Oxford, where he also serves as the director of the Center for the Study of African Economies. In addition to his academic work, Stefan has served in the policy world, both as the chief economist at the Department for International Development in the UK and as a policy advisor to the UK's foreign secretary. Stefan has also published a great book called Gambling on Development about the importance of an elite bargain in low-income countries for kickstarting growth and development. I hope you enjoy the show. Stefan Durcan, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Curtis. Well, it's nice to be here.
We had you on, well, a different podcast a few years ago. It's been a while since the CCI podcast. That was back in 2022, so now almost 4 years ago. Your book, Gambling on Development, it had just come out. And so in that 2022 podcast, you and I talked a lot about the main point of your book, this idea of an elite bargain and development bargain between elites being this essential thing for economic growth. So now, you know, fast forward for today's conversation, I basically wanted to do a little retrospective and focus on, you know, what's happened in the years since the book's publication, and especially on, like, okay, you have this idea. How has it actually been operationalized in the real world? But before, you know, before we dive in, maybe just for new listeners, maybe you could just give a brief explainer of the idea of an elite bargain for development and why you see it as sort of the essential thing for economic growth and takeoff growth.
Right. So where I started from also in the book, and I was thinking about it, is, you know, we see these quite striking disparities between, you know, some of the poorer countries beginning to take off in growth, or at least doing reasonably well, and then others being totally stagnant. And you know, if we simply put it in a growth perspective, is to say, look, there was about 49 countries that were low-income countries around 1990. Half of them ended up, you know, growing reasonably well, and the other half didn't. And if you just, you know, one overall population weighted, they were growing by more than 5% per capita per year as a whole group. But if we divide them up between better growers and slower growers, you know, you have a whole bunch of countries essentially stagnated. Where in fact some actually even declined in size. And so for me, the puzzle always is a bit like, you know, look, you know, countries that, and you can look at some of the characteristics, although income in a particular period, you know, some begin to take off on others. And it's like, you know, why would that happen in the same global circumstances? Yes, there's this difference in histories, but there are African countries that take off and there's African countries that didn't. Ethiopia, Ghana grew quite well. And then you got others, DRC and Nigeria, that actually either went down like DRC or actually were stagnant. And for me, you know, looking at this is to just try to think about it, you know, who holds that up? You know, if it's clearly possible to grow, what is it that blocks this? And that comes into the political economy, the politics of a place. And this is a bit like where I use a bit like Douglas North, arguably, that say, look, the way to look at states is to think about a coalition of elite groups, you know, and not because I like elites, because I believe that they are the great enlightened people of the society, but because they have the power to block. They hold power. And not least, in these kind of lower income countries that we know from lots of other work, institutions are quite weak. So political economic institutions to start with are pretty weak. So obviously the actions and behaviors of individuals is going to matter quite a lot. And that's somehow that I want to capture in saying, look, you want to understand what's the underlying elite bargain, the deal that exists between elites in countries, and actually ask yourself, is that growth-oriented, is that development-oriented or not? Okay, so look, we can have a lot further discussion around it, but, you know, when you look at a lot of these case studies, as I did in the book, you see somehow that in Ethiopia, for example, you know, the elite bargain was maybe not very broad-based, but one thing they definitely had is that elite bargain was about, you know, our legitimacy comes from growth and from development. You can go to the DRC. Similarly, the elite bargain is not many people, but you have very little sign. that it is that the lead bargain is anything to do with development. It's largely about let's control the state to be predatory. And so you get very different settings and things. And it's not as simple as bringing it down to politics, because, you know, Ghana, working as a democracy, managed to actually do a really remarkable per capita growth rate, well above 3% per year since 1990 in per capita terms, while you have other democracies like Malawi essentially being stagnant, you know, about 1% growth or something per capita in the same period since 1990. So this is a bit like, you know, it's not about simple political systems. And because, or indeed, even market choices, Ethiopia much more state-led than say, Ghana did. It's not quite that. And it's actually, you want to look at that elite bargain. You want to understand what drives it, why they're doing it. And actually, as your entry point to understand, you know, what's possible here, what can we do? And, you know, it has a bit of a sobering conclusion, is that if there's no elite bargain, it's incredibly, if there's no elite bargain for development, but just a kind of more rent distribution deal only, it's just very hard to get anything going. You know, as an outsider, it's limited. Or indeed, you go further. Some countries, they don't even seem to have an elite bargain, a deal that actually brings some stability. You look at Sudan today, South Sudan for many periods of time. That's not an elite bargain for stability, a minimal thing. It's actually just totally broken, and actually elites fighting each other to get control. And so then, you know, how can we actually get growth and development? So, yeah, so it's that mixture of trying to understand and realize that within weak institutions, some countries manage to actually progress, looking at the actions, behaviors, motivations of elites players. And then you observe, yeah, across case studies also in Asia, but I looked, mostly on Africa in the examples, we see that, yeah, some one way or another, there is somehow a deal, a bargain for development. Not perfect, never perfect, but there's progress. And that was kind of the big idea. Use that lens to understand where a country is going, why it's going, where it's going, and maybe look for your entry points starting from there.
Okay, good. So right, we've got this idea. You published this book in 2022. It makes the rounds. Lots of folks read the book, which is great. Congratulations. So big question is, what have you been working on since then to operationalize this concept of an elite bargain? We'll start there and go from there.
What I've been up to. So one thing that, you know, anyone writing a book or thinking about writing a book and say, well, do it, especially if you can pitch it reasonably well. And this was not for the general public, but definitely people interested in development. It's quite interesting because a lot of people want to talk to you. So one of the things that I realized is that I've been very busy talking about what I'm just talking to you about. But I must say, as an academic, it's quite striking because most of the time, nobody really wants to talk to you. And usually the other academics want to criticize your work and make your life hard. And it's a kind of struggle. So it's the one thing that I want to say. It's been fascinating because, you know, one of these people are not very good at saying no. And I think I must have, if it's not 100, it will be close to 100 talks about the book, small groups, bigger groups and whatever. And that's been at least for the one thing interesting is that, you know, there is a, you know, it's not that I can prove in some kind of pure causal or even total analytical political science or economic way that this is the right framework. It seems to help people to think about what they're doing, whether it's within countries, people that are acting within it, or indeed outside as external agencies. So I felt like it's actually giving them a bit of a chance or a bit, giving them a bit of an entry point to think about how should I approach getting involved in a country? So that's a bit like what I've been up to. And it's actually then trying to clarify this a bit more. You know, how can you, if you're working inside a country, actually take some of these ideas forward? And if you're from the outside, as I mean, aid communities or international agencies, you know, what is it that you could do better by actually taking into account this lens of looking at a problem? So I spent quite a bit of time in it. And so, but also the interest was clearly there. And in fact, you know, bumped into one president of a philanthropic organization and basically suggested, well, why don't you put a book in practice? And it was just music to my ears, because it was something like, say, look, I always wanted to do it. Because one thing that I'd learned working in DFID, in Department for International Development at the time in the UK, when it still existed as chief economist, is that, you know, there's a lot of things that we know wants to change, but the understanding the politics of a place provides you with that entry point. And so it gave an opportunity to do a little bit what we there did internally, to actually do it a bit at scale. So what we've done now is we've been able to set up a small group of people. We have some funding. And actually, we're trying to offer countries that actually are interested in beginning to get some growth-oriented reforms. Can we actually help them to give, call it second opinions, call it ideas about how other countries may have done it, and not in the spirit of perfection, but how do you overcome the blockers of any of your changes? And to actually have a very political lens in doing it. So there's a number of countries, and can talk a bit more about it, that all the way to prime minister said, you know, a bit like, if you're so smart, why did you come and help me pushing through some growth-oriented reforms, which is tough, okay, and it's a very tough place, it's actually Pakistan, can actually do this, or in other places where we know the people are trying to do it, and help them, giving them a sense of how countries have ever done it, and so on. So we don't try to, and I think that's really important, because one of the things that I think now, in other words, you know, that I've also learned, you know, if I talk about, oh, it's all about elite bargains, you know, an economist, a political scientist understands it.
Right.
But if I talk to an agency, it's, oh, I can't talk about this, you know, it sounds all very elitist and I can't do it. But in a sense, another way of putting it is to say, look, if I want to progress, I want growth coalitions, I want development coalitions that have to go beyond simply the minister or the government. But it has to involve people in senior civil servants, business community, civil society organizations. And actually beginning to talk about, you know, helping doing reform is also helping to build a coalition of support that actually can help you to lengthen the horizon of the political process, lengthen the horizon of what you can do, getting a bit of, I'm not saying consensus because it's always virtually impossible, at least a coalition of broadly like-minded people that can actually progress. So that's what we seem to be doing in a number of countries. And, you know, we've had fascinating time, you know, going from Laos to Madagascar, Ethiopia, Uganda, Somalia, Sierra Leone. Not saying we're doing work there, but all had entry points, explored it. And just this kind of meeting these people that, you know, they want change. They are in a position that potentially they could be influential in the change,
right,
but actually find it very hard to get that group of people together, that coalition to actually do it. And so we kind of want to talk about the economics of it, because, you know, one of the other things I know as someone who's worked in advisory work in the UK government and beyond, you know, the biggest role of the advisor is really to stop stupid things. You know, the rest is the key thing, helping them make sure that the ideas, what they're trying to do, makes broadly sense. But then also talk about, you know, can we help you understand who will try to block it? How can we think about it, the sequencing and so on? And I find it, you know, fascinating to do this. And and it brings economics in contact with the reality of policymaking within a political environment. So that's what I've been up to. And it's, you know, beyond, of course, writing occasionally my research papers, I still have a job, so I have to do that stuff. But anyway, but that's largely how we're trying to take this forward now. Yeah.
And give us an example of one of these engagements. Because I know, as I mentioned before we started recording here, I called some people. I talked with Pascal, who you work with at Economic Policy Network. You know, he mentioned some of the countries that have had some engagement with. So you mentioned the Prime Minister of Pakistan. So run us through sort of like what does an engagement look like? You know, I could imagine, right, there's different specializations involved in skill sets, because there's, you know, you, Stephen Durkan at Oxford, a, you know, well-known economist who's been at DFID and whatnot, you can fly into a place and open some doors that maybe some other folks wouldn't be able to open. But I would also imagine the engagement would involve, you could say it, local teams or at least people steeped in the nuances of Pakistani needs for reform. And so just, it'd be great. Run us through the Pakistan example and sort of what's gone on there.
Okay, so there's lots of layers there and to do it. You know, and I want to actually more fundamentally, you know, this typical thing where you kind of want to do change in an imperfect world. You know, you have a dilemma. You have a dilemma where you have to ask yourself, what is your own legitimacy to do this? And what's the legitimacy of people you work with? Okay? Again, I must say, like all these countries, and Pakistan is no exception, let me simply say, and there will be people listening to this and say, well, why would you even want to work in Pakistan? You know, you would question, and there would be people that want to question, you know, the power structures there. There's people in uniform having positions of power in that society. There are political issues that are not at all fully resolved. There are issues to do with, you know, the nature of democracy and how well it functions or well it doesn't function and so on. So you could have lots of interesting ideas about it. But for me, that illustrates, first of all, the kind of countries where, you know, where the change is most needed. Okay. And, you know, we make our choices as people working in development and also related to growth is that kind of saying, look, yes, you know, do we wait until history catches up with these places and they have perfect institutions? Or do we actually want to engage in the world of imperfection? You know, I know you're sitting in Tanzania now. Let's say it's a bit complicated, okay, in certain circumstances to work in places like that. Okay? Now that's the reality we're in it, and we make these choices. And I want to actually say that I'm not stupid and naive, and I'm not here as a kind of, in fact, none of the engagement is like, you know, with this massive contract and we'll do anything for anyone and whatever. So this question you have to ask. So our judgment had to be, you know, is there something we can do? And I'm actually now a strong believer that unless we get these economies to also begin to function and to create some growth, there won't be any resources for poverty reduction. There won't be resources for health and education. So I'm kind of taking that choice now and people can question that. And so the engagement is a little bit like, first of all, I want to emphasize that, thinking a bit carefully, just do it with your eyes wide open. You know, you're going into a country, it's a messy place, it's a complicated place, but I do have a sense that country economically is on its knees. It's doing the 25th or 24th or 25th, depending on how you count it, IMF program, the largest number in the world, and it's stagnant. Its eastern neighbor, with whom it doesn't get on too well, used to be only 15 years ago on the same GDP per capita. Now it's 50% GDP per capita higher, which much better social indicators and whatever. And say, look, there is some stagnation here. So you kind of say, look. And the question that came to me, and it's a much more fun story, one day I'll write it up in a book one day when I feel like I can do it without breaking the confidence. But at some point, a request comes, you know, can you help? And a few people that say, look, generally kind of want to say, look, we need to try to get out of this rut of these repeated IMF programs. Can we actually grow the economy? Can we get our balance of payments sorting and so on? So that's
and the entry. And this ask came after the book was published.
It came after the book. And in fact, The book was instrumental that some people had seen it. And I'm not saying that the prime minister read the book or whatever, but people around it were aware of this. And I had given definitely, because actually before that, I was asked to give a talk. Let me not name the institution that had invited me, but it was an international institution that asked me to give a talk. And they literally asked me, can you say the things that we can't say? Okay. So I had talked about, you know, the elite capture, the vested interest in Pakistan, the things that were there. So, and indeed, I was widely reported in the press. So, you know, they could have done their due diligence that I had not minced my words in terms of how I thought about it, what blocks Pakistan. But, you know, you're sitting there and, you know, at the same time, I've worked inside governments enough to say, look, you have to work with the grain. You know, you try to do it and it's a complicated thing. So I want to say, so the way we went about it was, I think, really, we were lucky in some senses because I was asked by the prime minister, can you write me a homegrown economic agenda? And I had to reply and say, no, I can't. I can't write homegrown economic agenda. You know, exactly. And I'm sure he didn't mean it like that, but it's definitely one of the better moments when you went to see. But basically, all the good ideas about Pakistan have been said by Pakistani economists.
Right.
Now, as with most policy advice in a country itself, most of the bad ideas have also been said by other people in Pakistan, including economists. So I saw my role largely as actually trying to say, well, with all the ideas that are there, can one get somehow a reasonably coherent picture and actually bring that together? So there's not that we were saying it. And so, but at the same time, you work in the government. So the first task was to get a sense of what the civil servants themselves were proposing. And so the main role I actually played initially was the proposals that already were there on the table on the growth plans, helping with local economists inside the prime minister's office to actually say, well, what makes sense, what doesn't make sense, and helping to do that. A bit of second opinion, okay? So, and using a little bit there. Of course, I'm pretty sure that the prime minister was partly attracted because he could say Oxford, but I always remained low-key. It was leaked, it was in the press, I was accused of all kinds of things, including getting very rich from this. And I kind of wondered, maybe I should have become very rich from this, but I thought not. It was entirely pro bono, and it actually is largely, there's no money paid by the prime minister, there's no contract with the prime minister, so you're kind of very informal. But I do want to emphasize that it's so important if you work in a country, you know, that is in the spirit of the book. If the ideas are not from there, right, and indeed, if the ideas are not owned to some extent by the civil servants and the politicians, there's no point. So there's no point writing these beautiful, glossy flagship reports as some organizations will do, and this is the 100 things you need to do. No, and it's not perfect. It's extremely second best. What they are actually implementing is not perfect, and it's absolutely not. But then we fortunately had to, but then the one thing, and I think I've definitely learned that of how to think about it, you know, you need, so I argued early on, in fact, there was a bit of a precedent. I wrote something in the newspaper before the prime minister reached out, and that's the one thing that that triggered it, not to say what to do, but how to do it. And how to do it included, try to signal your commitment. You know, that's the idea of the book as well. You need to create a sense that there is commitment of growth. Now, Pakistan is a complicated place, and lots of things are said and very few things are done. So this is a hard one. So you have to find a few things that you could do. Unfortunately, I think we at some point managed to hit on something, which is essentially, the biggest constraint for Pakistan, its economy. We'll have a longer conversation about it. It basically doesn't sell anything to the world. You know, these days it's very popular again to do lots of industrial policy and being saying we can do protection and so on to build it up. But my simple line is, if you want to do learning by doing, if you haven't learned after 30 years, you probably never learn, okay? And so yeah, one of these economies where import substitution has been the policy for 30 years and they're still there. And in fact, all the data suggests they're becoming less competitive rather than more competitive as a result.
Right.
Very obvious thing, but it is one of these examples. So it kind of said, look, you need to become outsource oriented. You must be one of the last Asian economies that is not trying to sell to the rest of the world. Now it's a late moment, and we can question whether it's the right moment to do this, but it has to be a signal. And one of the great things is, in a complicated country, tariff reform is actually an easy reform because you only need the cabinet to approve that. Regulatory reform, you have to have loads of people willing to do it and implement it and follow it, and the bureaucrats at all levels, all kinds of local government, national level, it's much harder. You know, you work on urban things, land policy reform, good luck with it, okay?
That is so many things.
So we found something that we can do quickly, can signal, and it's a tariff reform. But it also was a little bit, and now I'm going to be more provocative, if anyone related to the Pakistan thing listens to, it's provocative in some sense because it smokes out the vested interests that are living off the rents. Yep. And so you basically get now endless meetings, including some that many of them I've attended, where people invent all kinds of reasons why the tariffs need to stay. And basically you see very much the firms that actually would never be competitive and are doing it, because in sense, what we need here is a structural reform. Removing import substitution is to actually say, look, bit of creative destruction is required. There will be firms that actually shouldn't really exist because they only can exist because it's entirely protected for 20, 30 years. And there's other firms that never come up because all the capitalism is allocated. And so kind of we're smoking out some of the vested interests that block it. Now, of course, I discover quickly that there's plenty of vested interests that will do all we can in a complicated place than Pakistan trying to block the thing. And so, yeah, so we're still in that phase. But the reform is being implemented. The first year has been done. Nobody believes that they will get to the 5 years. But meanwhile, the commitment seems to be there from the people to do this. Now, of course, we need much more. There's no economy that changes just by that. So it's that slow grind of, can we find bit by bit doing the things that begin to start shifting the incentives? And in the process, which is then the harder one, build up a bit of a coalition of people for whom it's in the interest to dynamically, in a dynamic political economy thing, to actually keep on beginning to defend these gains that you can have. And so
right.
I'm traveling next Monday to Karachi, not to Islamabad, talking to exporters. You know, you need them to also be vocal that actually, look, these are the kind of things that help us. And maybe there's a few other things that can help us as well. And so you begin to shift there because, and, you know, moving tax incentives away from import substitutors to exporters and so on. And yeah, but that structural change. And it, of course, hits vested interests, left, right, and center. So yeah, so you're trying to do this and helping there. The outsider like I am, you know, if at some point vested interests are so strong, and I leave it to the imagination who some of these vested interests would be, I may never get a visa again. Okay, that's fine. You know, I may actually become difficult because I'm stepping on toes of those vested interests I shouldn't be on. And at the moment, I have a very easy visa, but maybe I may not be able to do it. That's fine. And that's another part of it. I learned the role of the external can be to say the things that's much harder for the internal think tanks and so on to say, because they need to still live in these places. They can do
it. I mean, isn't this kind of famously what the sort of IMF does? It kind of can play the boogeyman that tells the hard truth to the government, like, and it can be the sort of scapegoat in some respects, right?
But it is in two ways there. You know. So I you know. Do I love the IMF? Do I not like the IMF? I think a lot will then depend on the people again, you know, that they actually think through this. Because, you know, the IMF often gives you the perfect blueprint. Doesn't necessarily easily invest in what's feasible, what's not. I think they can play the scapegoat and they can be blamed. But being the scapegoat is never happening, helping with the ownership as well. Because actually one of the things, in fact, Danny Roderick wrote that a long time ago, is to actually say the problem with that kind of approach is that you may organize the opposition against it because it's very clearly an organization, a structural organization that offers you that. And it gives you explicitly. I see it much more. I try very hard not to be the one that gives the ideas itself, but helps those who have the ideas to be strengthened. So it's not my solution. It's not my solution and my proposals, but it actually is their proposals. But I help them to maneuver through to get a bit of a judgment. And that's actually a bit, hopefully a bit more subtle. I mean, there was a newspaper that that early on wrote, actually very positive about the reforms, but the title was Draconian Solutions, which was a little bit scary to get that kind of thing.
It sounds too close to Draconian Solutions, doesn't it?
Exactly. That was indeed the journalist that made the allusion to it. And because, of course, I was arguing for structural reforms, although the article said that's what we need. We need some real shocks to the thing. But at the same time, you know, you need to, you know, as I also in the book write and also in subsequent some papers, you need to understand the politics because, you know, and that's actually a problem with the IMF sometimes, is that it has a very small support base within it, maybe the technocratic minister of finance and the central bank governor. And actually by going too far too quickly in what's needed, even though it's the best thing to do and maybe it needs to be done, but they're going too fast too quickly or encouraging the minister to do a lot, it ends up actually with so much backlash that the one person, often, or the few people in government that really want to do the reforms get removed.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. They burn them. And so that's actually what I want to avoid. I can be it as an external, but it needs to be a bit more subtle. I mean, I'm not saying that I need to be subversive or whatever. Maybe I like to think a little bit as well that you want to actually change something. But no, it needs to work with the grain, because that's the only reform. And that's actually, I think, the difference with sometimes international organizations, which explicitly and unfortunately also explicitly I understand, but not implicitly, that they can't deal with the politics. Explicitly, right. They have to be purely technocratic.
Implicitly, and this is the World Bank.
Exactly. And the IMF as well. They cannot be. Yeah. It's in their charters one way or another. Of course, you know, subtly, hopefully they think through it. Because one of my points has been for a while now in saying, you know, it's not very different from the Chinese telling you non-interference. And we know that non-interference is interference. It's a way of interfering. IMF and World Bank saying we cannot be political is political. It's a political statement. It's actually saying, you know, look, I'm only work with the government and we only do that and whatever. No, it is political as well. And so I'm actually hopefully encouraging a bit more subtle. You know, if you want reform, you have to start understanding the political economy and who's blocking it and so on. And then adjust what you propose to these realities so that actually you can have success. If you want impact, you better understand that. And I think that I want to say is a bit of different rather than the IMF blueprint, which 25 times in Pakistan has been more or less the same blueprint. There must be a definition of madness, by the way. The same blueprint and then doing this 25 times. And in fact, I should add, of which less than 5 are recognized by the IMF as completed IMF programs. So, you know, there must be something to say, look, there must be another way of doing this. Can we actually find a way in? And beginning to do this. I'm not saying we succeed in that, but that clearly has to be the way, and linking probably also to the book, how externals should begin to be willing to think a bit more, is to say, look, there is a political reality. You know, we have to recognize that sequencing and prioritization needs to understand that political reality. And then begin to think about how can we change this, including all the way to, you know, maybe shifting that political reality implicitly a little bit to be more sensible on the economic policies and not. But you have to start with, you know, there's lots of reasons why, go back to where I started earlier, these, call it, you know, 20, 30 low income countries from 1990 that are still low income today.
Right.
Why they get stuck. And it's not because the advice has not been, objectively speaking, the right economic advice, or the Minister of Finance has never understood that. It has to do with their local political realities, that somehow or another, we have not been able to do the same thing as in other places. And I mean, collectively, we, the countries themselves, have not been able to get themselves on a growth path, while others have been able to do this.
Yeah. And so just kind of honing back into the Pakistan example, just to put a cherry on top. So You went there post book. You were invited by, let's say, a high, you know, a top official in Pakistan. You're prioritized kind of reform minded politicians and elites. That includes, it sounds like, trips to talk to exporters, which you're doing, which is more broad than just political elites. This is business elites and other types, to form a broad coalition of those supporting growth and development. It sounds like, too, in your answer, you prioritized, especially at the beginning, like doable things. And oftentimes that means second or even third best things, so that you actually get some quick wins on the board that signal a commitment to this bargain. Where are you at today? Like, just kind of to put a cherry on top, what have been the big successes with the Pakistan case today? And then we can move on.
Yeah, so you know, the you know, once we got some of the key people, this was the at the level of ministers, prime minister, to understand that, you know, I thought one of the biggest, almost intellectual breakthroughs that I had with some of them is to be able to find a way of explaining that, you know, if you think of the trade balance, that import substitution is not simply the other side of export promotion.
Right.
That is, in an accountancy sense, accountants would say I should be the same. I can suppress my imports or I can promote my exports. Both are will be helping me to get my trade balance sorted. And that you actually just talk about, you know, what are the different incentives you set? Okay. Once we had that, the focus on exports is then being things. So the successes has been helping to get somehow the tariff liberalization and the beginnings of tariff reductions, the first year of the five-year reform is done. Why do I call this a success? Because, you know, if we can keep on track and the next budget needs to have the second step and so on, if we can keep this on track, then like the technocrats in the World Bank became very useful. They simulated right. the reforms we proposed. And we actually can show that if it gets implemented, this would be 350,000 new jobs and 7% of GDP increase, you know? That's a lot of billions, by the way, okay?
Yeah.
So the rate of return, we may not get it through all full 5 years, we may not get it perfectly doing it. But the success was that if we quantified what of all the proposals that initially should have been implemented in the first year were implemented, and we got to something like 96% of the tariff reductions. There were a few places that they give in into something or whatever was implemented. I say, okay, that's a success. Now, one of the great things about that is that we've always said from the beginning, this is never going to be enough. There's no, competitive does not simply come from relative price shifts. You know, we had learned in the 1980s, right. It's not enough to get the prices right. There's other things needed. But it does put a lot of incentives on a lot of the other ministries to actually really begin to think, okay, what are my complementary things that I need to do to help to either remove regulatory stuff and so on. So there's momentum around it. I'm not going to blame credit for that. There's a lot of other people doing it. And I should actually say it involves a huge amount of local people. There's some top level, I won't name them now, top level academics or experienced former, you know, Pakistani former people that worked in both in government and international organizations that are very involved. There is a whole delivery team that's entirely Pakistani. There's all kind of advisors that are operating there. That's now donor funded. That's great. The donors are funding all this, but it is all still around more or less the same kind of principles. You know, they're doing it. I would say, will it change Pakistan? You know, several friends and some top academics to say, look, it may well fail, but we know one day we need to do this and see how far we get. And this is also a bit how reform works. You know, it's a bit of, you make a bit of progress and then maybe back, but then the next time is there. You know, you're sitting in Tanzania, it's unrecognizably different. You're sitting in Zanzibar, especially, it's unrecognizably different from what it was in the 1980s and 90s.
Yeah.
That does mean there's a lot has changed in the economy, many and many things for better that actually, you know, has real effect. So that's a bit like we're there. And so, yeah, we keep on going. We have conversations with the prime ministers. We provide immediate advice. We give second opinions. We're supporting things. We're sitting very regularly talking to different people. And actually, we got to a slightly different phase. Now, initially, I was very much committed to stay in the background. So even though, you know, it was all leaked that I was involved, and as I said, all the kind of newspaper coverage that I was going to be earning millions from it. It's strange as an academic to be exposed to that, I must say. But it is what it is. But then leading to the point where now I've not actively done that, you know, publicly. This is actually the first time that I'm going for a visit where I'll do a series of much more public things. But interestingly, you know, within, you know, there's no one controls me. And just being able to talk, you know, what needs to be done, but how to say, not, you know, yeah, not trying to say these are my proposals or whatever. So everything is basically all the time sourced from others. And yeah. So, yeah, I'm a bit cautious in terms of where we are because there's some real sensitive things that we need to find a way to get through. And I'm not saying that that it's stock market sensitive in that sense, but it's actually a bit sensitive in terms of the kind of things where we have blockages and it's doing it. But yeah, it's been, and I must say, what started initially very few people believing this could be possible, you know, the idea, at least among some senior civil servants, some the prime minister, and, you know, there's lots of other processes in parallel, but there is a more and more coherence around it. Mm. And that's actually quite satisfying that, you know, you're just one cock in something, you know, with one set of outside connections,
right?
One set of being positioned in a way that you can be a little bit more an honest broker also with also some international organizations, just as another person they will talk to, but helping to broker a bit, you know, that's quite useful. So it's, we're not going to say, you know, this becomes a world of contribution rather than attribution, if you see what I mean. You know,
right.
But we're now one set of more people and more people that actually are beginning to see, well, maybe there's a window of opportunity. By the way, in an absolutely complicated place, and yes, it's only a small part of all the things that may need to change in that country, but would be nice that we got a bit of minimally sustainable growth going for a bit of time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, to your point, you don't need to, you know, change all the policies all at once. You can have some wins in doable, politically tractable policy areas that demonstrate success. And then you build on that momentum with bigger stuff later down the road. Right. So, and I think that's how kind of reform in East Asia and China kind of played itself out too. They chose very strategic areas and then got some wins under their belt before tackling the harder problems with the bigger, scarier vested interests that you have to contend with. But before I ask the next question, Stefan, just for listeners, just to clarify, the organizational home for this, is it CSAE or is it the Economic Policy Network with Pascal? What's the home for this work?
Yep. I'm not going to try to explain the complexities of the way itself.
Yeah,
let's say we are doing this from the Blavatnik School of Government. The Center for the Study of African Economies is the kind of organizational home. We work under the NOMER Economic Policy Network. We are quite low key, you know, because we are doing all this work in many of these places. It's all entirely pro bono. We just do have some private foundations supporting us. And yes, so and we bring up because we're making links with some other places as well. Some colleagues in Georgetown University will join us and other people as well. So it's not just me and Pascal that you mentioned earlier. It's actually broadening, but it's all with a set of like-minded people that in different countries we're trying to do this, use our own connection, so to speak, to be somehow able to be seen as relative to trustworthy, not just after another management consultancy or delivery contract, not after a contract we fund it, but actually say, can we help you maneuver through difficult things related to through the economy? And that's, yeah. And so the Economic Policy Network will be the plain vanilla name that we work on at the moment. Simply to say, look, you know, this is going to be in some sense to the outside world relatively low key, but it's trying to be, you know, trusted people that those people in countries that we have a sense that they're somewhat committed to try to get economies to function, you know, in ways that are not extractive, but can be also become quite more inclusive and creating jobs and better living standards for people, that we want to try to work where we're in these kind of places. Yes. So, that's it.
So that's good. So we have a broader backdrop for, you're right, there's this idea of an elite bargain written about in the 2022 book. You're now operationalizing this idea. It's across several countries. We went over the example of Pakistan. You've got sort of an organizational home at Blavatnik in Oxford and CSAE and the Economic Policy Network. I'm curious, sort of 4 years on, what's been the prior that you held back at the book's publication that you've since updated most as a result of actually doing the dirty work of operationalizing the idea of an elite bargain?
So one of the things that, you know, one of the things I did actually soon after book was published, I went on sabbatical and I spent quite a bit of time in countries I didn't know well, Senegal, Niger, Madagascar, and so on, places that intrigued me. This was before the coup in Niger, by the way. And so we spent some time in just trying to think about it. And I mean, there's something about the history of these countries. They're actually relative to some of the, you know, East African countries. They're actually all a little bit smaller. And actually having, let's call it, a slightly more, a different post-colonial experience. Let me put it simply, very, very politely. It's quite French still, okay? And so It did make me think, because of course the Sahel countries, geopolitically, they became more important already for a while, security issues and so on. So the one thing that I think I realized that if I had spent time in these countries before I wrote a book, there would have been a chapter to actually thinking a bit more deeply about the link between local elites and international elites. And basically, in this case, for example, French business elites or French political elites. And of course, now that was, I think, 2022. And then just look at the world today. You wouldn't write a book as this anymore without actually putting geopolitics much more at the center of these elite markets. And so one of the priors that I definitely have to change here is that there's probably two or three. The first thing is, you know, and just in, and I don't know whether there's an alternative, but it's basically what is a way out for a country? Now, definitely if we go back in the period between 1990 and about 2020, export orientation was a very obvious way out. Not so much only because, you know, globalization and so on created the markets. It was there. It was just so much more, you know, the market access was so increasing for developed countries. We know it so much the Asian countries did it. So there was an engine of growth that's available outside you that you can lock into that is not dependent on your domestic markets developing. And so that's great. And you see Bangladesh and so on using it to real great effect. But related to that, why export orientation is so important is that I used the example there in Pakistan as well. You know, once you get into the input substituting rut, it's extremely hard to get out of. And I'm actually people promoting industrial policy cannot ignore that. You know, that's a bit of the history is that it creates opportunities to either do this really well in a very disciplined way as maybe Korea did, or it creates all kinds of incentives that I see Pakistan doing it, where it just becomes a massive rent-seeking opportunity. And basically you end up learning by doing for 30 years and not learning, but just, and not doing anything either, by the way. So that's the thing. Now, with the geopolitics, I'm not so sure that that opportunity is as strong anymore as it was. Now, I'm not saying it's definitely gone, and a lot of people are thinking about it, and a lot of people argue maybe it's not. But that's definitely a change, because it means it's a little bit more pessimistic look forward looking. That actually, it's not going to be so easy to use the kind of access to global markets engine of actually getting going. So that's a hard one, because you have to be more inward looking. Okay, and I know you work on urbanization things and so on. And all these things are also to have a link with, not necessarily the same, but have a link with domestic engines of growth and so on, have to do it. But there, the political economy is so much more complicated immediately because there's no benchmark. You know, there's no international price to benchmark against it. It becomes more persuasion. This is efficient. This is the right policy. This is the right thing. And where export orientation has this very clear thing, do you sell anything or not? And the second one related to this is with the geopolitics turning as it is, it will make it the incentives for the status quo in these countries will suddenly have improved dramatically. Think of the DRC, where in the age of international cooperation, say between the late 1990s and 2020, aid was allowed in this world of globalization to be quite technocratic, because it became quite complementary. In fact, there's another dimension, the outward orientation of Western countries to actually defend or promote the Western liberal, the international liberal order, meant also, you know, in the security space and so on, that aid was a very welcome guest to do it really well, because military solutions weren't enough. You know, we needed to do things in fragile states. We needed to do things, but it was not to just keep regimes to friend. It was actually generally trying to do, can I help to stabilize? Can we actually do state building? I'm not saying we succeeded, but it was actually an age, and not, I say not at all that we succeeded, but it was an age where aid had the legitimacy to actually doing as good as it could do. And World Bank, IMF had mandates to actually being technocratic. I may criticize that I may be doing it too much, but at the same time, they could do it. Think of what happens in geopolitics now. And I've heard it already in closed meetings being said, oh, surely we should keep on giving aid to the DRC because they have rare earth minerals. You know, you see the deals that the US is doing, all for its own self political and other interests. You know, that's deals with the status quo. You know, that's actually indistinguishable. The incentives are now indistinguishable what everybody was accusing in the previous age of China doing.
You know? Right.
And the incentives for the status quo will be dramatic because, no, we'll do a deal with you because we get access to your mining. We get access to the stuff, you know. We'll give aid to the DRC, not because we think we'll do it in a way that maybe we'll transform this to a better functioning, better institutionally functioning, maybe better economic and politically governed state. No, no, because you have rare minerals. And right. So, well, that's the last thing you do. So that's what I also probably would have had. And so basically, a fat chapter on the geopolitics and the consequences of it. That's what I definitely changed my mind. And it makes it a bit more less optimistic that indeed local elite bargains can actually strengthen themselves, that success breeds success, and we can actually get change in the world country by country because the world is a bit more a difficult place for them to maneuver in.
Yeah. One more question on operationalizing this idea, Stefan. So I'm curious, and I kind of alluded to this a little earlier, but I'm curious about what are the different teams and specializations across, you could call it the reform journey, that either you've seen emerge slowly as you do this work within your network of policy folks, you have yourself and others kind of flying around trying to influence economic policy. Yeah, what specializations and teams have emerged across this reform journey as you've pushed forward on implementation?
Okay, so look, So probably the most important one is really is that, I mean, look, I still look at largely at economic reform, economic decision making, but it would apply to all kinds of other areas as well, whether it's health or education or whatever. I think what you need to develop in your teams is not embedding hard-nosed, theory-grounded political scientists, although I like talking to them. But what you want is somehow creating in these teams, either it's through having the right people, but actually even just having the right attitude in these teams, that you're stepping in a local reality.
Mm.
And a local reality is different to say, you know, this is, say, the first best. It's actually recognizing and understanding that it's not just that the local reality will just frustrate you because they don't want to do, you know, the perfect health policy, perfect education policy, but actually the more you know about the local reality, you may get better ideas about how you may actually act. So it becomes people that become more not simply knowledgeable about the what, but how can one actually do things in a place. Now, what I don't mean there is that, you know, as we, I also worry about in the current geopolitics, that businesses with all the anti-corruption acts and so on disappearing in the US, how to get things done may have very simple solutions of how to get things done. I don't mean it at all like that. You know, that's another how. But it's basically say, well, how do I actually work in this place, and how do I begin to think about how I can make progress? And what I simply mean there is basically people skilled in asking the right questions on local teams as well, using knowledge from other places. You know, it's like if I'm going to do fuel subsidy reform, the technical part, for example, will take you about 3.5 minutes. Okay. it's a bad idea, fuel subsidies. Okay, there's not much to be said. I can teach in my first class to a student in economics 101 that fuel subsidies sound like a bad idea. Okay, I can do that. But how to get it done needs a lot of thinking, because it is about lots of vested interest, how they get mobilized, how do you actually begin to compensate, how you sequence it, how you lock things in, how you build a political narrative around it. And that's actually the kind of people that you also want around you, because that's the reality anyone you deal with sits in, and you can't leave it to them. It's your problem. You know, you can't simply say, finance minister, my condition for you is going to be the abolition of fuel subsidy immediately. You do so much better by actually telling them, okay, and we know about these and these places that they did it like this. It's not best practice necessarily, but maybe you can do it. Maybe you can talk country X, maybe you can talk to Indonesian former finance minister, how she did it in her country, how she actually did it. And you begin to build up a picture. It's like, wow, it's actually quite similar in lots of countries. It may be specific in my country, but how I can get things done. So that's the minimal amount. And then the related thing is respect for the difficulty for well-meaning politician to implement. Even if they want to do it, how it will work, and basically just recognizing that, you know, so many reforms are proposed that within, and not necessarily with the worst intentions, but within bureaucratic politics, that is the usual office politics, as well as within bureaucratic politics, that's not the usual office politics, but more malign, and including the political vested interest and all the interactions with them, implementation is tough everywhere. And that actually, you don't simply say, oh, McKinsey will just do a delivery unit and implement it, because then we'll create lots of fakery. The data that will come up are fake and so on. I mean, not necessarily, but I'm definitely not a fan to actually turn this into a pure technocratic delivery thing. But again, to have people that help to think through, can I actually deliver this? Can I do it? Is this the one that I can deliver? I mean, like talking Pakistan, we're talking about regulatory reform. And even some of the ministers are highly skeptical that they actually can get it done. Even very well, you know, very well positioned people that say, well, can you actually get it done? Can you not done? Because actually, you know, we just don't sometimes know enough about the internal bottlenecks and properly doing it. They don't really know. They don't fully understand. They get impatient. But yeah, just really thinking and getting that part documented, you know, get more people that work on reforms helping to document, you know, but what's the change of decision-making? How many people can actually potentially block it in the system, the bureaucracy? How long is that chain? Can we first maybe actually make that change slower before we try to do the reform and so on? Respect for that. I'm almost saying respect for that, recognizing that, so that you don't simply, so far more focusing on how things get done, how you get things implemented, than just what needs to be done. The what is actually not that hard.
Not the hard part, yeah.
A lot of sensible things that have long time been proposed in all the countries, but how to get it done is the hardest part. And we just have, and I just say respect for it is a minimal amount. Interest, intellectual interest in it, that you want to understand it, rather than this kind of arrogance, often also external teams saying, why don't they just do it? You know, why don't they do big bang, change everything in one go? No.
Yeah.
It doesn't work like that.
So this is interesting, because as you were talking about, okay, like how do we actually bring folks, policymakers through this reform journey, is there something to like a reform funnel? Like I'm thinking, so I had a chat with Pascal, as I mentioned, who helps you on the Economic Policy Network, about my former life before I went back and did a graduate degree. I was in software sales, believe it or not. This was a long time ago, seven. And in software sales, there were like whole sub teams within the broader sales team dedicated to specific parts of the sales funnel, right? So at the beginning of the sales funnel, there's a whole team dedicated to qualifying potential leads. Basically, like basically they needed to pinpoint like four pieces of information to qualify a potential sale. And I can't believe I'm telling you this, but like there was an acronym we were taught called BANT, which is budget, authority, need, and timeline. And so if a lead, if you're talking to a lead on a discovery call and they had a budget, they had authority, or they had authorization from the right authority. If they had like articulated on the call a clear business need for the software solution. And then lastly, if they had an explicit timeline in mind, this lead was basically like, quote unquote, qualified. And then went further down the sales funnel to, they had a call with an account executive to discuss a potential tailored software package for the specific need that was identified. And then if an appropriate package was identified, like a demo is the next step in the sales funnel. A demo is typically given with pricing for the various packages that you've pinpointed. And then right finally, you get to the part of the funnel where there's eventually a no or a go or no go decision made by this potential client, right? And so that's basically the sales funnel. Obviously, afterwards, if the client decides to buy, there's this post-sale part where a whole kind of customer support team is brought in, and you want the client to effectively use the software, right? And so bring this back to my chat with Pascal. I was thinking, at every stage of the funnel I just outlined, I see like analogous ties to the journey that you would need to take a would-be reformer on, right? So like, I guess, Stefan, what I'm asking is, are you just a glorified salesman taking, you know, would-be buyers down this reform funnel?
Well, the idea that I'm a glorified salesman, is the thing. But look, there is an element to it. I mean, you know, we also conceptualize this a bit of like, you know, and it's, you know, as with all processes, as all ways of doing things, it's helpful to have a bit of a staged way of thinking about it. Okay. Mm. And so at least we know, we know now, and we're trying, and, you know, every context is a bit different, just as every person you're trying to sell to has a little bit of a variation on what you describe, and it may not be as beautifully sequential, but we think about it, you know, look, the most important thing, and that definitely comes back from also the writing in the book, is that, you know, we need to find a way of assessing first, kind of, do they mean it? Do they actually want to generally do this? You know, do they not want just a window dressing of an Oxford team or a Georgetown team or something that actually just, you know, it's good to be associated with this good kind of thing. So you kind of, it's a bit like with the sales, you know, are they genuinely interested in really getting a solution rather than just enjoying
the interaction? And in sales, you wanted to get to know as fast as humanly possible so that you can just get on to the next person.
That's exactly right. So we kind of, this actually illustrates for us that I find it really helpful that we are not trying to get contracts with anyone, that we actually can do this actually just like pro bono, because it allows us to walk away. We need to be able, just as you have to stop the conversation, I mean, you're selling, we want to create the opportunity to walk away. But at the same time, you need to find ways of testing the commitment.
Right.
And this is a bit like where you come back. And then, of course, it can go together. You know, in Pakistan, there were definitely moments early on that we felt like this is absolutely zero commitment. And there was a particular conversation with an extremely senior person where I kind of said, look, there's no point for us to do this, because you want to say these things when you act in another way. It actually had to do with increasing the tariffs while you said you wanted to reduce them. You can't do both at the same time initially. And so you kind of testing. So we're trying to have a process where we say, can we actually test a bit of the commitment? We begin to do a bit of a diagnosis. What's possible? What is it doing? And it actually has meant, in quite a few countries, where we had great interactions all the way up to presidents, but we just don't think there is at all a commitment to do anything. Either because what they want you to do feels like glorified window dressing or unrealistic kind of thing, having the name attached to it to do it. Or in another case where we just say, look, no, that absolutely don't give a damn. They're mostly, and let me not name the country involved, but let's say they're more interested in drug smuggling than actually doing anything on the economy. We're much more interested in harboring probably the biggest cocaine, one of the biggest cocaine traders in Europe, than actually doing anything else. Okay, so I say, right. Okay, that's not quite commitment for general economic reform. So you want to step back. So that's definitely part of the process. And for us, the process is also to then, try to, we're trying hard not to hold the pen too much. It's like saying the commitment has to be, you need to do the things. It's hard at times and know the context, and occasionally we have written things and notes and so on, but they have to write their own reforms. This cannot be our blueprint of what to do. We can say we can help them prioritizing and so on. There is a clear process. We want to step away because that's not our advantage or comparative advantage or absolute advantage either. But it's definitely not in terms of we're going to now deliver it. Being the support of the delivery and so on. I wish in all these countries the bureaucracy would deliver it. Habits get created that for all the things I was earlier describing, people are in a hurry and they'd rather bring in organizations that are setting up some of the parallel process and doing it. Don't like it entirely at all. Well, I don't like it at all. But we hope that they either deliver themselves, as indeed in some countries, or indeed that it's other people doing it, and doing it. So we want to be in that early phase. That's a bit like, probably your sales team. Now I hand it over to another team that will actually make you the package. So we get the outline of the package. That's as far as we go. Probably these are the principles, the ideas. But then, you go and source across your own organization or elsewhere what the details of the package has to be. And so that's where we are in the kind of thing. But at the same time, and that's an important thing even when you're selling, you can't set up something that then later on someone down the line can't deliver for you. So that's also what I have in mind. So the economists often say the policy implications are we need stronger institutions. So we need stronger property rights to say, that's really helpful. That's really, really helpful. That's actually quite useless, And it's the kind of thing, of course, I agree that that if we get a pure democracy in the long run, we'll have, that the evidence seems to suggest Asimoglu's paper, it's all great. But tell me, how do I get there? How do I get there? That would I find much more useful as an advisory kind of thing. And so it's that things. And I wanted just the people who give the advice also in the pure economic sense, that they are giving the advice, keeping in mind that process that you described down the line, that actually the advice is associated there with what you understand can be done, what can be prioritized, what are the bottlenecks and so on. And that's probably where definitely the biggest learning is that, your sales team needs to be disciplined or knowledgeable about what happens down the line.
Yeah. Okay, I'm being cognizant of time because I know you had a hard stop in, I believe, 7 minutes or so. So I had three or four questions I needed to get through here. And let's hope we can get it before your call here in 7 minutes. So the one is, is your work just dealing with, or so far over the last 4 years, is your work just dealing with national governments? I'm at the Africa Urban Lab. Have you worked with any city or regional governments? I'm thinking one of the supposed benefits of federalism or decentralization is that you can experiment with new policies at the local level and then scale up those experiments if they work more broadly across the country. Are you guys taking this approach at all, or is it more focused at the national level?
Look, we're trying to be as much, on the one hand, demand-driven and opportunity-driven. We haven't had quite the opportunity to do what you just described. You could imagine, even Nigeria, particular states, where to say, look, we want you really to work with you on something here. And if there is we would do it. But it is broader than actually just national government. So the idea is really in the end, if I go back to where we started and say, look, I strongly believe that the if we don't get a strong enough, what I can call it, an elite coalition together, things will be blocked. But there's various ways to try to get that. And elites are broadly defined. You know, these are leaders in politics, in civil society, in senior civil service, can be the military, can be religious leaders, traditional leaders, and so on. So if we get an entry point in the other side, so it's a bit like motivating. I'm not being the one that's going to create a growth coalition in Pakistan, but I'm very happy to talk to the business community to try to actually say, look, you know, this is the kind of things that actually would probably help you with get bits of growth. And, you know, if they can be implicitly become part of it. But it also means in Madagascar, we were beginning to work with civil society organization that generally said there's a window of opportunity with the resetting of the new government that's coming to power. They find their feet. Let's actually engage them. And they were asking us, you know, okay, but how would we engage? What would make sense? And so on. We're very happy to do that. If there's a business confederation in another country, we would be very happily doing this. So it's open. If there's demand and if we feel like we can contribute, for us, the whole thing is always about, is there a chance that this will make the big prize to getting these economies to function better, to grow better, improves it? And again, you know, not in a naive sort of way, it's not just natural resource growth, but just, you know, with all the benefits that it can bring to have some form of inclusive growth going. But basically that the price, if we feel like, and if we can sense it and justify and stress test and asking ourselves, will it really do? And so that's, again, I said, well, we then may walk away at some point and say, if I'm making it up now, the civil society organization we work with, they have no levers, there's no entry point, you know, just making noise, that's not what we will be doing. And mm-hmm. so yeah. But local governments, yeah, it's possible. You know, they can be important engines, and they may have lots of things under their control that you could maybe want to help them with. Yeah.
Well, hey, the AUL is here working with cities, so let us know. So, realizing time, a couple more questions, more focused on broadly economic growth. Right at the end of the day, that's what these policy reforms that you guys are pursuing aims to bring about. So more broadly, like, what are the, I'm sure you have to make the case for growth sometimes, right? And as an economist, that might be kind of confusing or frustrating, making the case, but what are the arguments against economic growth that you take most seriously, right? I know there's a ton of straw man critiques of growth that I think can be dismissed out of hand, but what are the critiques you take most seriously, and you know, how do you respond to them?
No. So the one thing is that, you know, I would be very happily join petitions that would argue in the US or in Europe or in Singapore that, you know, zero growth is not bad if we think sensibly through it. You know, I see it much more in you know, you get a critique on an environmental side. You know, there's even, you know, one of the biggest advocates of green focus and climate change issues in the World Bank basically wrote a series of papers where it's saying, look, if we get growth that alleviates all the poverty in low-income countries, it is so marginal in its contribution to climate change that it's probably very happily a price worth paying. So in a sense, the green argument, you know, we want this to be sustainable, but in this first phase, we want to focus it. So I take it seriously for you know, the Chinese growth model. I take it seriously for the US or European growth model to actually not, you know, really be willing to say, look, you know, degrowth is not necessarily the worst thing if we handle it really sensible. But I don't want it to constrain. So I happily listen to these arguments, but say, look, in the cases I'm considering, I'm using the evidence that actually the impact of that is minimal. The other part of it, it's that, you know, we just know from the evidence that not a single country has sustainably reduced extreme poverty without actually growing, you know, and it's this part of it. I never want to argue, and there's some people writing papers. I know Land Pritchard writing papers, it's a necessary and sufficient condition. You know, I mean, look, there's a lot of endogeneity there going on there. You know, I'm pretty sure that for countries to sustain growth, they will have to make it inclusive. Otherwise, the revolt will be there and the whole thing. So there's something there. But, you know, the argument that it's the wrong focus for some of these poorest countries, no, it's not. It's actually probably a very reasonable focus because we just need to do it. I mean, I did recently looked at the numbers and, you know, low-income countries in 1990, as I said, they grew per capita by 5.4%. The countries that moved out of the low-income status into lower middle income or above brought their poverty down from 70% in extreme poverty in the World Bank measures to 13%, while the ones who didn't manage to progress into lower middle income country or above, they went from 70% to 68%. Okay. You know, it is a big part of it and it's never sufficient, but we need to enough focus on it. And I do think the international community with all the support, and that included DFID, you know, we are so focused on poverty, but there's just no point often working on the poverty side if we can't get these economies to function. And that's just saying, look, I want to spend my energies on it. I have huge respect for all the others that they're doing. Look, I'm a microeconomist from training. I started as a poverty economist. But we seem to have forgotten it, and we need to just focus on it as well. So, yeah. And I don't know, going further, you know, whether it's instrumental. It's never the end goal. It's always just an instrumental thing, the whole growth focus. You know, I just take it. But instrumentalism also means it seems to be a fairly good way of progressing something. And enlarging the cake gives you the opportunity to do all kinds of things. And without a large enough cake, we just can't do it.
Okay. And last question. I know we're at time. So after our chat in 2022, right? I think Open Philanthropy, now Coefficient Giving, they reached out to you for advice, I believe, on what a new sort of economic growth cause area could actually look like and the type of growth-oriented ideas you thought could be highly cost-effective that could be funded, right? It's been a few years since you wrote that up, but now this cause area, it's up and running. I think one of your former co-authors, Justin Sandifer, is running it at Coefficient Giving. So looking back at your list of ideas to drive growth, which ones of those that you listed have sort of increased in your favorability rating since writing it, and which have decreased, and why?
So, well, you know, I may well suffer now from having a good enough memory and a recall of exactly all the lists that I had. But look, you know, one of the things that I wrote up is also the things we're trying to do, you know, being somewhere, helping in a more neutral, honest sort of way, helping countries to think through the growth and a bit of the second opinion, the ownership. The things we're doing ourselves, of course, was part of that list. And I still would say it's a pretty useful thing to do. There are related, but things that definitely moved up in my list, and it has a little bit to do with the geopolitics as well. You know, things to do with more going beyond work around transparency with natural resources, going beyond it, is going to be very important. I mentioned already with the whole scramble for minerals, for
rare earth minerals,
or whatever. All that stuff will, and the incentives in the geopolitics to make it less important, that's where it comes from, the transparency around it, you know, it makes it more important because it is somehow one of these factors that, unfortunately, quite a lot of these elite bargains that get stuck is also because they can't somehow get out of these elite bargains where it's just distribution of the rents from natural resources. And that's going to be more and more important, because that holds, in the end, growth back. It's, again, it's not a technical thing. It's a lot to do with political economy. And that links to the proposals around illicit finance. And so one of the things that was weak in that set of proposals is that I don't know exactly how we're going to actually shift global political economy that actually they take it more seriously, not least because we may fight it in London and then it all pops up in Dubai and Singapore. It is that kind of issue. Whether it's illicit finance, whether it's about, all the things that happens with contracting and all this kind of the whole chain of that is there. You know, the corruption work. It's not that corruption itself is the biggest problem, but definitely corruption in natural resource contracts is definitely an essential part of elite bargains, because anything that happens there, that's big and it has massive consequences. This is not about a teacher asking for a small bribe for the teaching. This is real consequences for the growth picture in a country. So it's these things that I would find more important. But the harder thing is there is like, well, what are the entry points and how can we actually do something where it actually can be impactful? Okay. Mm. It's not about documenting and shouting, because these days we know that just talking about it doesn't shift many of the, given the geopolitics, doesn't shift many of the governments. So actually really finding way of how do we change it. So that's a bunch of it. Yeah. And the other bunch is probably, again, without an easy solution, but it's how you build up capacity locally in countries that doesn't get vulnerable too quickly to the local political economy, but at the same time can operate and doing some of the things that maybe also we do as externals now. You know, I mean, I wish we could do it, but in these countries with weak institutions and weak accountability, that also means if they don't like it, what you say, you know, you can be sidelined for a very long time. Or indeed working with the grain, working with a less than perfect government, trying to do a few reasonable things can mean that the next time you can never have a job anymore or whatever. Can we begin to find ways of building that? And so it's something there. And yeah, there's a few there. But, you know, I want to also emphasize my list was very much, you know, given what the international communities and the aid agency are already doing. I think the other part of it that I probably underestimated, that we also probably should think more about how we get them to function better, not least right. In this current politics, how we do that. And it's not just about accountability and transparency and NGO meetings of the World Bank with the NGOs. It's actually more generally thinking, you know, how do you work in that reality properly? You know, how do you work properly in it? And that has to do with maybe educating the boards of these places. But that, of course, we come back to geopolitics. You know, right. The geopolitics is probably going to make these organizations more transactional, more willing to do what they used to do in the 1980s, slightly ideological and so on, rather than actually anything else. So it's, I don't know exactly, but finding ways to get them to function better in doing it. Look, maybe also that I've been so pleasantly surprised how much interest there has been from inside these organizations at a very senior level in some of the things I've been talking about. Because they recognize, anyone who's made their hands dirty working on the ground with governments trying to do something, they recognize, it seems, what I clearly had experienced. And that's a very pleasing feeling that, you know, there's so many people have written to me that are in the system at all kinds of levels that says, look, I recognize this, you know, I recognize that thing to do. But not quite knowing how do we do it in these big organizations to make somehow making that a bigger reality. Because, you know, in the end, I hope what I was writing about is trying to also make all these outsiders more effective and being impactful without being patronizing, without being...
Right.
And that's... There's still more about it. I know... coefficient giving is still looking for good ideas around it, but it's hard because, you know, the things we're talking about are largely probabilistic because, you know, you're not delivering something with a very direct result. You're trying to actually kind of help somehow to shift the dial. And if it works, it would be amazing. But the probabilities of success are definitely well below one. and so that's the kind of thing, you know, can you get people in the comfort zone to more systematically think and invest in ideas and initiatives that are in its return probabilistic? So that's another part. And it's hard in the accountability of aid organizations. I've worked inside them. You want to be able to tell to Parliament, you know, every single penny had an impact. Every pound we spent, every time we spent had an impact. Now, that's not the game we're in, because I can't prove it. There will be countries where we fail and we're not getting anywhere. Maybe we'll shift the dial in a few places with very large returns. But that's what the business is. Yeah.
Okay, great. Well, that's it for the podcast. So, Stefan Durkan, thank you for coming on, as always.
Well, thank you, Curtis, for bearing with me. And anyone who's managed to listen to this part, it's great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to the Africa Urban Lab podcast. To listen to our other episodes, follow us on your favorite podcasting platform or subscribe to our YouTube channel. And pretty please, if you like the episode, share it with your friends and your network. It really, really helps grow the show. We appreciate it, and we appreciate you. Thanks so much.